And the motion picture is the most important art film ever devised by the human race. It is the art form that creates more empathy than any other. It creates our ability to step out of our own shoes.
Welcome to The Great Movies Pod, a retrospective film review show, the podcast where we watch and discuss each of the films covered in Roger Ebert's seminal film essay collection, The Great Movies. I'm Jana Gardner.
I'm Nick Fulton.
And I guess I'm Dylan Quayer.
This week, we are discussing Blow, a 2001 American biographical crime film directed by Ted Demme, starring Johnny Depp, Penelope Cruz. No, not that one.
I knew a kid in high school who said every time he watched it, he would cry, which is...
What?
Weirdest reaction to, like...
I have questions about him.
I have no answers.
What the F is this movie?
Johnny Depp plays a, like, cocaine drug kingpin.
It's like Scarface, but without the artistic flourishes.
It's like a boring Scarface.
But Scarface
like,
is already takes itself bad enough.
Serious. Well, yep. This is like Scarface takes itself more seriously and is boring.
Scarface is bad, I will give you that, but it does have artistic flourishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
It's going for some stuff. Sorry, but I got distracted. This week, we are discussing Blowout, a 1981 American neo-noir film written by Brian De Palma and starring John Travolta. No, not that one either.
As far as I've heard, that would probably be a better movie than the one we're
you know,
about.
I've never seen it, and I
Neither
have to say, until this week, I probably could never remember which one was which anyway. And yeah. They seem to have a lot in common, so maybe that's fair.
Blowout refers to a tire blowing out.
Is that really what Blowout's about? Well, isn't he like a sound guy?
Yeah, he's like a Foley artist guy. It's a cool movie. It's probably, we talked about this off air, but it's probably my favorite De Palma of the De Palmas I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Now,
I'll watch it eventually.
I don't want to spoil too much for the pod, but Nick, Blowout or Blow Up, which one's better?
I would have to watch Blowout again because I haven't seen it in a very long time. And I know before rewatching this, I would have said Blowout. And now I'm not sure.
All right. Well, fine. Let's get into it, because this week we are actually discussing Blow Up. Sometimes, by the way, stylized as one word, two words, or hyphenated, depending on where I saw it written.
What do you guys prefer out of those three?
I like it hyphenated.
Same.
I like it spaced.
Well, there you go. None of us like it one word, because that's no good.
No, that's bad. All
right. It is a 1966 mystery thriller directed by Michelangelo Antonioni, produced by Carlo Ponti, and it was Antonioni's first entirely English-language film. It stars David Hemmings, Vanessa Redgrave, Sarah Miles, John Cassel, Jane Birkin, Cy Chin, Peter Bowles, and Gillian Hills, as well as 1960s model Verushka playing herself. It features music, I think very good music, by jazz pianist Herbie Hancock, and the group The Yardbirds make an appearance as well. Are we going to fight about The Yardbirds? Like, honestly? Dylan. Not a 60s music guy. Not a
Jimmy Page guy.
All right. I can get into it later.
I'm shaking my head.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of head shaking on this episode.
I know. It's going to be a lot of just like head shaking. I will say yesterday I was getting ready for this before watching the movie. So I was trying to like get organized with information that was all non-spoilery. And so I was putting together all my research and outlines and stuff. And I saw that the Yardbirds were in it. And then I spent the rest of the day listening to old Yardbirds albums. So that's the... And it made me very happy. So I am secretly 70 years old. But
now that you have watched it, could this movie possibly be spoiled? Like, what could you possibly hear where you'd be...
No, I mean, I guess it could be spoiled just...
Knowing that there will be
nothing happens.
Yeah. Right, knowing that nothing happens.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of interesting to realize partway through, like, oh, we're not, this is not a typical, like, we're not going to solve a mystery here. That's not what this movie is about. But I think that kind of becomes apparent, like, you know, pretty early. It's not shocking at where things go necessarily, but that would be the only spoiler. For anyone who doesn't know, this movie, the narrative covers a day in the life of a fashion photographer played by David Hemmings, based on a real-life London fashion photographer from the swinging 60s, and basically follows him as he has a day, and he meet some people and take some pictures and maybe discovers a mystery and maybe doesn't and goes to a rock concert and a party, and he just has a really full day. And that is what happens in this movie. So I guess I will start with Dylan. What was your experience coming into this rewatch that I will rat you out and say you just finished like an hour ago?
Oh, shush.
I mean, I've done it before, so.
I know. Yeah, wasn't particularly excited to revisit this. I saw it sometime in high school. I remember. I remembered very little about the movie, and I realized watching the movie right now that everything I remembered about it was just the whole movie. This was like the exact opposite of The Big Heat.
Or Big Sleep.
Yeah. God, yeah. There's so many stupid big movies out there.
There really is, yeah.
But yeah, this feels exactly the opposite, where I felt like I don't remember much coming in, and instead of like the other one where it was like, whoa, this one was just like, oh, that was the whole movie.
That is the movie? Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah.
What about you, Nick? You'd seen it before too, right?
Yeah, it'd been a little while. I really like paranoid thrillers. So I think I'd seen both The Conversation and Blowout prior to this. And both of those are like a little bit more, they're both very good movies, but more traditional paranoid thriller types. Whereas this, we said that Belle du Jour is like neither erotic nor a thriller. This is, this Belle du Jour is to erotic thrillers as this is to paranoid thrillers in a way, where they don't really care about the mystery and he doesn't ever try to solve the mystery and they don't expect the viewer to try to solve the mystery. It's just something that happens. So I think the first time I saw it, I wasn't really prepared for that. And then I've seen a couple other Antonioni movies since then. And they all have done like very similar things. Like La Ventura is sort of a mystery film in a way, in as much as this one is.
Sure.
But I mean, it's, not that's not really what they care about. And then The Passengers got a similar tone. It doesn't have quite as much of a mystery, but I think on rewatching it I was more prepared for the tone and the pace of this movie, so I liked it a lot more.
Yeah, as I've said a bunch of times with these movies, this was yet another one that I hadn't seen before. Like I was saying, until last week I couldn't have told you which one was Blow Up and which one was Blow Out, so good to finally have that question settled. But like I've been saying, I really look forward to watching this again. I think it's the kind of movie for me that I would get a lot more out of seeing a second time, just being in, like you said, the right headspace to know, okay, this is, it's not going to be solving some big mystery. It's not like, you're not going to be like looking for clues necessarily. But it would be interesting to watch at least sort of the main, like sort of the centerpiece scene in terms of when he's actually at the park and what's happening and what he sees and what he doesn't again. I think would be kind of interesting. There's a lot of takes about this movie, both in the Ebert essay and other places I read online. That's kind of like, you know, what does he really see and not, and, you know, sort of what is his shaping his perspective. And I mostly agree with what seems to be Ebert's take, which is, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter. I don't think there's some great mystery there. He sees what he sees. It's just this strange event that is shaking him from his, you know, take a drink ennui that is so prevalent throughout the the rest of the movie.
We're going to say ennui a lot in this episode.
I saw you make that joke before I'd watched the movie, and I was like, huh, interesting. And then I watched it. I was like, oh, yeah.
The first, like, half of the movie, you really don't... I forgot that... you know, there's almost no ennui, or like, I guess after the fact you go, oh, like, well, that explains why he's this way.
Why he's so,
but he's just seemingly living a young man's life in 60s Britain. But then everything kind of falls apart and he's just an ennui machine.
Yeah, pretty much. And like you said, it does explain, like, those first couple scenes, why he's so strangely disengaged from what seems to be kind of a busy day he's having.
I think if there is any one style of movie I dislike the most, it's white male ennui.
You like Inside Llewyn Davis, right? That's kind of white male ennui.
Yeah, but it's a Coen Brother movie.
Well, sure. You know, this is a well-respected film also.
Sure.
I don't like it as much as I like Inside Llewyn Davis, but I don't like many movies as much as I like Inside Llewyn Davis, so that's kind of a top five for you, maybe? Yeah, it's like a top five all time for me, so that's kind of a tough bar to clear. Mm-hmm. One other thing, just before we get into the plot, such as it is, I had read a lot beforehand, too, and I watched the trailer before I watched this, and the trailer, I don't know if you guys watched it, it's just one of those, like, very 60s-style trailer that's, like, the title in big letters on the screen, and it's like, blow up, the sexy movie of the year. Exactly, and it's like loud music, and like anything that happens in the movie that's remotely action-y is just in that trailer. It's just like the with the models and the girls on the ground and the, like, in the park, and just everything is very like
fancy car shots.
Exactly, anything that could be remotely considered kind of action-y is in that trailer, so it seems like it's a really high octane kind of more of a traditional thriller.
As opposed
kind of
to
misleading.
I'm going to show wind blowing through bushes for 30 seconds.
Right. Or is him kind of walking down like the street looking over his shoulder.
Is this the 60s version of Drive?
Where mm-hmm.
I think the that's Drive a, trailer I think that's came a, out.
And everyone's like, Fast and the Furious. And then
they saw
Drive.
Like,
they were.
Oh, it's
so
just
mad.
Gosling staring like a minute.
Yes. Just standing silently in hallways. God, I love Drive.
Have you seen the meme where it's him and Carey Mulligan and he's like, do you like stuff? Yeah. And then it's just like 50 panels and them staring at each other and then him smashing that guy's face in with a shoe.
Oh my God. I've never seen that.
That sounds great.
Oh, such a good movie. But no, that's actually a great sort of comparison because the trailer kind of makes it seem like he lives this high pace, kind of like the first 20 minutes make it seem like, and then before everything just kind of devolves for him a little bit. And the other thing is that I read some reviews that were like the bright colors of, you know, mod swinging 60s London, which again, I think is really only kind of true in that beginning sequence. Like it's not that,
There's also the Yardbirds.
There is also the Yardbirds that we'll get to that scene.
That's a weird scene.
It's a weird scene. I found it so deeply unsettling, which I guess is the point. Like, you know, Ebert's essay calls it out and everything. They were going for something there, but it, I think, purposefully is... we'll get to it, but it just, it really threw me. I was so confused. Like, what is happening? Like, as I told you guys last night, by that point in the movie, I'm like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know. I don't know who any of these people are or what's going on. But let's start at the beginning, where... from minute one, actually, I wasn't quite sure what was going on because the movie just opens with good opening titles, by the way,
yes.
And good Herbie Hancock music right away at the beginning. But so it opens with the some people call them face painted clowns. Apparently, according to Ebert, these are young college students in England who, I guess, once a year at some point during the year, paint their faces and then drive around asking people for money for charity. I have no context for that. It kind of just seems like they are youths who are haranguing people for money in the street. Very strange. And they're all painted up to look like mimes. But so it sort of starts with this chaotic opening. But then it cuts pretty quickly to all these sad looking men walking out of this big building. And I was like, is this a factory shift ending? Are these guys getting released from prison? Like, I was not familiar enough with the idea that this would be apparently just a flop house, just a boarding house for low-income workers, apparently.
He calls it later, the term he uses is a DOS house.
Mm-hmm. Which I wrote like, that down. I'd never heard it before.
I'd never heard it before. I don't know if it's like a British term or what, but I looked it up. And I guess like a homeless shelter.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's like, kind of like a shelter, maybe, kind of boarding house type place where you can sleep for the night before you go back out and look for work or go to your bummer of a job. I just wrote down drudgery, ? it's so sad. Like, they're all kind of just like shuffling out. But then, you know, he sort of breaks off from this group and then you can tell that he is our protagonist and he has a fancy car and his camera and he is, you know, we eventually... or quickly learn that he is making a book and he wants to document sort of the difference between his high fashion photography and then the real life of these sad men who he is spending time with in this DOS house. But he leaves there. He goes back to house studio. I don't know if this is where he lives or just where he shoots photos or both.
I think it's kind just of a studio because I...
Is it just the studio?
I was under the impression that he lived, like, adjacent to... I don't even know the characters' names. I don't know any of the characters' names in this movie. What's her name? Sarah Miles?
That's the actress, yes. Yeah.
I was under the impression that he was neighbors with them and the studio was just, like, nearby, but...
I learned that from the Ebert essay when I was like, oh, okay, that's his neighbor. Cool. I put the pieces together there after the fact. But yeah, you're right. That's their neighbor. And so this is just his studio. I like the shot of like the big 39, the address when they drive up. Mm. I'm kind of a sucker for the sort of dramatic visuals like that. And like, this is where we get our mod 60s, like the models and... We already joked off air about it's just like Austin Powers. It's hard. And Ebert calls it out his essay, too. Mm. Like, you know, he wrote the Ebert essay was written in 98. And when we talk about it later, it's the most 1998 like time capsule essay.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a lot of late 90s hangups in his column. But he does shout out kind of complimentary about Austin Powers lampooning this. Mm-hmm. And it is one of those things where I can't see Austin Powers when I see the swinging London of the 60s. Is that, I take it you guys had that same impression?
Oh, yeah.
I've seen that first movie so many times. So, mm-hmm. like, as soon as David starts doing, when he's shooting Varushka and he's like, yes. No.
No. God. I mean, at least he didn't, like, do, like, the little, I think of is, like, the little animal thing.
That's the best.
Yeah, and it does, I mean, I realize it has to be a knowing parody. Like, this movie is pretty famous, and to have Austin Powers be that sort of swinging photographer and interacting with the model that way, I think it's a pretty knowing, winking reference to this movie, which I appreciate. It makes me like it more, even though I thought it was hilarious at the time, and I really had no idea what it was parodying. When I saw Austin Powers when I was 14,
oh yes,
I had no idea what you were going on about. Because
Austin Powers came out in what, 96, I think?
96 or 97, because Spy Who Shagged Me was like 99, I think.
Yeah, so I was, what, 11 or 12?
Really?
11 or 12 when I saw this. I had not seen Blow Up. I wasn't watching,
right,
you know, Italian/British art films. Oh, so that joke in Austin Powers is funny on its own, and now after the fact, it's just like this extra little bonus.
Yeah. Well, the Austin Powers thing is so funny. I remember when I saw it the first time, it was because a friend showed up with a VHS tape, like, from Blockbuster, because no one saw Austin Powers, the first one, in theaters.
Oh, no.
Like, it was not a hit.
Really?
It's truly strange that it got a sequel. It made very little money in its initial run. I definitely didn't see it. But then a friend brought a VHS over, and it was hilarious, and we watched it, like, 3 times in a weekend. To steal a fun fact from the Blank Check podcast, Austin Powers is one of the only franchises where the sequel made more in its opening weekend than the original movie did in its entire theatrical run.
Wow.
So Spy Who Shagged Me made opening weekend more than original Austin Powers made altogether.
I wonder, like, if Endgame did that with Iron Man.
Probably.
I bet it did.
300 million? I bet. Yeah, the only other sort of 1-2 that does that is Pitch Perfect. Pitch Perfect 1, Pitch Perfect 2.
Oh, wow. Really?
Pitch Perfect 2,
I remember them talking about that.
Much worse movie than Pitch Perfect 1. Jesus, it's bad.
Man, they did Hailee Steinfeld so wrong in that movie.
I know, I love her.
So do I, but it's a bad role.
That's
like, it's a bad thing. Like, my problem...
Everything.
My problem with that movie, among... It's a bad movie.
Everything?
Yeah.
But they're building up to, like, oh, we're going to do an original. But the original sucks.
And the German...
That
German
song stuck in my head a lot, though, anyway, and it's so bad.
The German people sang such a better song than they did, honestly.
I mean, that's the critique of Pitch Perfect 2, is that the other boot group is so much better. Mm-hmm. At least...
Well, that's also
one,
the critique of Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, so...
I have not. I'm familiar, but I have not seen Emmett Otter's
Wait, are you
Jug
saying
Band
that,
Christmas.
Are you saying that Emmett Otter is better than the River Bottom Nightmare Band?
Oh, wait, no, that's right. The River Bottom.
Because the River Bottom Nightmare Band wins. Spoilers for Emmett
they
Otter.
Yeah, they won.
Oh, no. Well, now I'm never going to see it. Had it spoiled for me.
You should. It's delightful.
It is wonderful.
Pitch Perfect 2 is probably the most disappointed I've been. Well, I also saw Rise of Skywalker, but probably yes. the most disappointed I've been close to it compared to level of excitement. Like, Pitch Perfect, I am so obsessed with that movie. Like, I own it on Blu-ray. I used to just put it on, like, just to have on while I was doing
it's
things in
one.
My house. It's a fun one.
Yeah.
The songs are good. Big fan. And then, man, what a bad sequel. So I never saw 3. That's how mad I was at 2. I've never seen Pitch Perfect 3.
Three,
a movie that exists.
3 was on, like, HBO or something, and we watched maybe the first 10 minutes of it, and similar to Pacific Rim 2, I made it about 10 minutes and I was just like, absolutely not. It will only ruin the first one for me. There's no way I'm going to enjoy whatever they do after.
But 2 already ruined the first one for you.
Yeah.
Two didn't quite ruin the first one for me, but you know, I'm not going to watch it again because I don't want to risk it.
Yeah. Yeah. It could go that direction. All right. So now that we've gone through a Pitch Perfect tangent, we were talking Austin Powers. I can get us back there.
And talking about
reverse engineer.
Blow up. So he has, you know, he's in this studio. I think there's some good looks. I even like the styling of the studio. I remember thinking like, oh, I like he has like an assistant guy who's got a cool shirt. Mm-hmm. Got some like cool mugs. I'm like, I like this whole look. I like the 60s mod fashion. I like the hair.
I hate it so much.
That's just crazy. It's a cool look. It's a cool look. I'll stop bringing up Austin Powers, but when I was obsessed with Heather Graham in that movie, like in particular, I thought that was the epitome of like what an attractive woman should look like was Heather Graham in Austin Powers, the Spy Who Shagged Me.
Is someone who saw that when they were 13, you are not going to get disagreements
right?
from me.
I was going to say, it probably was just that like I was like 14 and I'm like, that's what like pretty ladies look like. But yeah, I like the looks. I kind of like the photo shoot he does with like the 4 or 5 models. Mm-hmm. Like it's very... They're all in the row.
Yeah, I like the way the panels are set up, and later when they go back to it, they shoot from like behind all the panels and it looks really cool.
Yeah. just not your aesthetic, Dylan.
No.
Well, it's not
so annoying.
In fairness to you, Dylan, it's not his aesthetic either. Like he's
right.
he clearly hates his job.
Yeah, right. No, I get it, but like okay. Mm-hmm. Something that just like came up to me when I was watching this movie, and it's just like from the last few movies we've watched, it's just like and this obviously was not like a consideration of male directors back then, but the fact that like every single woman in every single one of these movies has to be like size 0 and like super gorgeous,
it would be the same if it were made today. If they made this movie today, it would be the same.
I don't doubt the possibility, but it's just like the movies that keep coming up right now recently, it's just gross. I feel very gross watching these movies.
I'm afraid you're probably gonna hate next week's movie, but at least like Kathleen Turner, like she's a real actress with mm-hmm. I don't know, she's not
what's the next week's movie
face. Body Heat.
God. God damn it.
Yeah. We're on a real run for you here. I know, like Nick says, you can kind of tell that I already forgot. What's our main character's name here?
Thomas?
I think it's Daniel.
I
think I was thinking of David Hemmings and I would have said Daniel.
Yes, his name is Thomas, which I had to just look. I almost called him David also.
But I called him Daniel.
So, yeah, he's not really feeling it either. Maybe you can remember the context of this. I think he has this sort of like adversarial exchange with Varushka. I think it's with Varushka when they're kind of like pushing back and forth on each other. He's not happy. She's kind of annoyed with him. Is it her that he asks, who were you with last night?
Yeah.
Like sort of accusatorily. And that's when you're kind of like, okay, he doesn't respect any of these people or anything about this process. Like, he is just, he's a gross dude.
Yeah.
Like, he's not.
I hate him so much.
He's not, He's not a good person.
Yeah. No. But he's not also interesting. Like, yeah, he clearly is like the serious artist type, mm-hmm. and he like this is the means with which he makes money. So it right. seems like he resents yeah. Varushka and all the other models. Like he's
exactly
so just like dismissive and rude. He's such an asshole to them. Mm-hmm. But it's, I mean, not that it excuses that, but that's part of like his whole thing, his whole dissatisfaction mm-hmm. with life, is wrapped up in this, where his art is being like debased to doing something commercial right. and superficial.
Yeah.
God, that's yeah, such no, an he, eye roll for me though.
He's total, I will say, I did actually draw a little like eye roll face in my notes at one point, because that's kind of the whole, that's the only reaction you can have.
Yeah,
to him.
But like his quote unquote real art, like, is taking like photographs of strangers in parks without their permission and
sure
shit.
Or even like taking photographs like, of like down on their luck people
yeah, yeah
who like, are like living in homeless shelters basically.
Like, he's a completely uninteresting, distasteful, and disgusting character. Like, there's nothing that at least draws me to him at all.
See, I don't, I mean, I think he's definitely, like, a gross jerk.
Yeah, of course.
But I don't find him, like, for me at least, that doesn't, like, disengage me from the movie.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't like affect my ability to want to see where this goes.
And oftentimes it actively engages me more than
yeah.
nice characters, like, I don't
but
know,
I
nice
found
character.
It so unengaging, that's the thing. Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, I for me it works how, you know, he's kind of this like avatar of the time. It's the late 60s and everyone's struggling between consumerism and artistic value, and he's so checked out, and you know, for the time and place it was made, I think it's kind of interesting, and I am kind of drawn in by his like ridiculous jerkness. Bad guy, wouldn't want to hang out with him. But
ooh,
I
yeah.
did, I did like, I'm not gonna read them all, but I found myself just like writing down all the terrible things he was saying to the models, like in the group photo shoot when he's like shouting at them that like how lucky they are to be working with him, and at one point he's like, smile, God, and it's like, okay,
have you,
buddy,
I think he says, like, have you forgotten what a smile is?
Yeah, he really sort of lays into them. I also, the only other photo shoot note I had was like, there's this very, I think, kind of obvious cut, like right after he's finished like screaming at Varushka and they finish their photo shoot, and it cuts to like her laying on the ground and he's like sprawled out on the couch. And it's just like, it's pretty much like an after sex mm-hmm. kind of, you know, like this is his, the way he engages with his work, and it's pretty creepy. Although I will say, final photo shoot note, I really liked the peacock outfit that one model had. That's like all like the peacock feathers and the pattern. It's a good look. So yes, now, yes. Okay. Now this is when he leaves, and he does go home. He leaves his studio. He goes to another place that is his home. And that's where we meet his neighbors, who is like his painter friend and his girlfriend, wife, pretty lady.
I mean, he doesn't even know at one point in the movie when he's right. talking about.
Yeah, this is my continued, who are these? Who is this woman? Yeah.
She's with,
what is their relationship?
Yeah, she's with like, the painter guy,
right,
ultimately.
She's with the painter guy.
But I think in this scene, it's pretty unclear
yeah.
who she's with. Because I was under the impression yeah. she was with Thomas.
Right, yeah. It seems like she's maybe his girlfriend. They definitely, her name is Patricia, by the way, mm-hmm. according to
sure.
Wikipedia. I could have said any name right there, and you guys
yeah,
have been
like,
yeah
okay,
Linda?
That.
Yeah, absolutely. Her name is Patricia. They definitely have a weird vibe, and it's not exactly, like you said, clear what the nature of their relationship is. What did you do after that? There's a good needle drop of the Loving Spoonful. Just the good 60s music, man. Like, I'm such a sucker for it. This is the music I grew up listening to entirely. So I know all these bands. Like, my dad was 18 in 1966. So, like, it's just, that's all I heard. That's all I listened to. And this is when, right around here, is when we meet the blonde and brunette who mm-hmm. we don't know their names because the movie does not name them other than being the blonde and the brunette. Jane Birkin as the blonde of the famous expensive purse, and an actress named Jillian Hills as the brunette. And this is when we first see them chasing him. They chase him outside. I can't remember when he first encounters them. But they obviously know him and they want to be models. At least it's implied that they want to spend time with him, be models, have their photos taken. And it's just more of this, like, this poor guy, how sad for him. He's got these beautiful young women chasing him down that he's got no time for, no interest in. You know, it's
a tough life.
Not the most, right? It's not the most sympathetic.
Hate that character. Or characterization, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Hate it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I was going to try to say something redeeming, but no. I think it works as far as making it very clear who this guy is. But no, it's not super fun to watch him be terrible, too.
No.
I find the first half of this movie, like, kind of challenging. I mean, I get what it's going for. Like, you have to have him.
It sounds like you're giving it a lot of credit for it, though.
Yeah, well, you have to have him be this way in order for, like, the third act, like, tone shift or his overall, like, attitude shift to work. But it doesn't make it any easier to sit through him just, like, being a miserable little prick for the first, you know, hour, basically, of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how it worked for me, at least, as well, too, where I spent the first time like, why am I watching this guy? Like,
right.
What's his point? But for me, at least, it does pay off in the second half and more so in the final act when things get real weird towards the end there.
I guess I cared so little about him and the film cares so little about the mystery that I didn't care about the movie.
Well, if you don't care about him and the movie doesn't care about the mystery and you don't even like the aesthetics, then yeah, I'm not sure what you're holding on to.
I will say this. There's nothing too much like Belle de Jour that had me like absolutely disgusted beyond measure and had me hating it. It was just there, and that was it to me. It wasn't terrible.
The funny things about this is that I expected it to be more controversial. Like, I expected it to be more like Belle de Jour, because I have heard of this, and I remember thinking that, like, oh, that movie was like super scandalous, and then, you know, some ladies take their tops off, you know, and there's some implied sex that happens. Yeah. Right, exactly. There's off-screen three-way and people do drugs. I just don't know what would have, I guess that's what would have been so scandalous back then. But I was bracing myself for like, either like that it was going to be violent or more graphic or something. And it's all,
happens
it's,
in this
but no, pretty much nothing happens
okay,
in this movie.
I really want to compare it to another movie that the other thing, like, I couldn't stop thinking about while watching it, which was, this reminded me a lot of Burning, which I believe you both have seen.
I have a note towards the end of my notes comparing this to Burning.
I didn't even think about that, but that's a good call.
And I think Burning is a lot better.
Well, Burning's like a masterpiece.
Yeah, Burning is one
Burning.
Of my favorite movies of the
yeah.
last decade.
I was going to say, Burning is one of my,
yeah. But I think Burning does some things. I mean, it's also kind of a distasteful main character that doesn't seem to care much. But the interaction with the Steve Ewan character and I can't remember the girl's name. I think is a lot better than, like, you know, almost Harvey Weinsteining people for, like, is it not? I mean, he's like forcing people to kind of sleep for their own personal gains.
Definitely it is. Not
like,
to be
I
all,
don't fucking care about him. Like,
not to be all Catherine Deneuve about it, but it is kind of like, I'm just not shocked. Like, not that that behavior was ever appropriate or acceptable or anything, but Ebert makes a point in his essay that
when the movie
came out, it was controversial because, like, you might see full frontal nudity, but there apparently was no controversy over how he treats any of the women in this movie. And we'll.
I'm glad he shout out. Like, he did shout out how like.
This was bad. One of Ebert's better. Yeah.
Oh, this was his best review so far. I loved his review.
He doesn't comment at all on any of like the women's attractiveness or their skimpy outfits or anything. So, good work from Ebert there.
Yeah.
But to your point, I don't think that the movie is taking his side. Like, I think the movie is aware of how he's acting. I don't think it's...
Mm-hmm.
I agree, but it's also like, when we talked about 8.5, it's like, it doesn't necessarily take... I don't remember the director's name.
Fellini?
No, the director in the movie.
Guido?
Guido. It doesn't take Guido's side in, like, objectifying and abusing, right. Like, emotionally abusing women.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, but then also Fellini's over here objectifying and emotionally abusing women on his set. So, like, even if it understands, like, I don't give a fuck if the portrait or the character or the people behind it don't also fucking care.
Yeah, I mean, not that it
I can't separate the art from the artist when the art is saying something and the artists are doing the same thing.
I'm saying not that it matters, because it doesn't particularly matter to me as much. But I don't know anything about Antonioni. Bad guy, good guy.
I don't know.
No, just a
okay. It's Italian.
Like, he's dead now, so like I don't Italian. Really care how good of a guy he was.
That's fair.
Right. Yeah, no, and I just was curious because you brought up the sort of the Fellini thing. But yeah, no, it doesn't bother me. Maybe it should.
That's fine. I can understand, but it just that kind of stuff doesn't really takes me out.
Yeah, it does not. So, all right, we're almost getting to where things start happening-ish in this movie, or
yeah.
start and stop happening kind of right at the yes. same time. But
there's like one thing that happens in the whole
right,
movie.
Right, and then, yeah. So he goes to he drives off. I wrote down a note about the dudes with the poodles. Like, there is what seems to be like a gay couple who walks throughout this movie with like some really cute poodles that I'm just like, oh, that's kind of fun. All right. Goes to an antique shop. And then makes his way to the park, where he chases some birds for a while.
That was so funny.
That sequence, I was just like, what are you doing with these birds, bud? I did enjoy that quite a bit. But then he gets distracted by seeing a couple sort of like walking up this hill. And I'll say from the first second I see them, I'm like, okay, well, these are people having some sort of affair. Like they're in work type clothes. They're in a park. This is not, or at least I got the impression, this is not just like a married couple, like just out on a stroll together. Like it seems illicit.
It seems like
they're sneaking around in their business attire. So
this little offshoot section of the park, you have to go up some stairs
to get
to.
So it's just sort of framed for me from the beginning in terms of like the mystery of what's going on and why is she so freaked out. I'm like, because of this affair she's clearly having. But he chases them up. Because he respects nobody's privacy and art above all and wants to take their photo. I did sort of write in my notes, like, okay, here's Vanessa Redgrave, because that's, like, the only thing I knew about this movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, she's in it, right? Like, she's going to show up at some point. She shows up at this point and then basically watches them frolic through a big open field in a park and takes a bunch of photos and then eventually gets spotted taking their photos, and Vanessa Redgrave runs after him, asks to, you know, for him to give up the film. He won't do it, and then she runs off in a truly strange sequence where she sort of like runs halfway and then like stares at him, and then I don't know if it's like the shoes she's wearing or how it's shot, but her run was just very funny to me. She like runs off towards the horizon and away from him. But yeah, weird scene. I don't know what I thought. And I knew the concept of this movie was he sees something, he takes some photos. So I was watching that scene with this in mind, and I'm like, but nothing happened. Like, what? What are we supposed to think happened here? Like, I don't... How could there have secretly been
murder? To be fair, like, the scene where you do realize what happens is probably mm-hmm. one of the best scenes in the movie.
Sure, yeah.
It's very well made, like, the...
Yeah, I mean, that's the one. Yeah, we'll get there in just a second. Yeah. But, like, that's the one scene that sort of everyone shouts out as like a, you know, masterpiece of editing and things. This was not super that for me. It was just kind of like, what a weird exchange. This couple who, and like, and again, you know, to me it seemed obvious that she wanted this film because she was just out having an affair with this old guy and just wanted to cover her tracks. Yeah, I didn't want to get caught. Not that she was up to anything, like there was something illegal or violent happening, but just
or that this was a setup to have this person murdered.
Right, exactly. I also, this is where I made the note, like, this film is not particularly subtle about the idea of, like, a photographer as a voyeur. You know, like, it's really not at all. And then in this scene in particular, it's like, okay, well, now he's just a creep. I kind of stopped just, like, writing down lines out of context that I don't remember why I wrote them down. But I wrote down, it's not my fault if there's no peace. This is another him being a jerk to her, I think. Like, I can't even remember. He just says a lot of mean things to a lot of people, basically, throughout the movie.
Nick, what are you saying?
Oh, I was going to say, is it then or is it when he's meeting with the guy when he's talking about his book that he's talking about? Because I know...
When he goes back
the painter?
And talks... Or when he talks to his agent?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I have written that it's his agent with, like you, intoned a question mark in parentheses after the word agent, I think.
It's his agent, right?
That's what it seemed like. Somebody who was somehow involved
in the creative
process.
They're looking at like proofs of the book and talking about what he can do that'll make the book sell better and stuff. So I think,
I do want to just quickly mention, going back a little bit, the character Bill, who's the painter that he briefly talks to, is played by John Castle, who really should have been like one of the biggest actors of the 60s and 70s. But he was only really in this and The Lion and Winter, and he's so good in Lion and Winter. And then he just did RoboCop 3.
Yeah. I like looked him up to see what happened to him just now, thinking maybe he died or something, but
no, he was in the 2003 movie Gods and Generals.
Sure. The Civil War movie?
Have either of you guys seen Lion and Winter?
Nope.
I have, like, when I was very young. I haven't seen it in a long time. I remember it.
It's a very not-me movie that I still really enjoy. Mm-hmm. And it's mainly for the performances, including his. He like, holds his own against Anthony Hopkins and Peter O'Toole and Katharine Hepburn and Timothy Dalton's in that movie, even.
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, yeah, I did know that. Oh, speaking of Peter O'Toole, this guy, John Castle, is also in Man of La Mancha, the musical movie starring Peter O'Toole.
Really?
Not. Yeah. You guys seen Man of La Mancha? It's kind of good.
I haven't, no.
I've seen Lost in La Mancha.
God, I love Peter O'Toole.
Yeah, he's good.
Peter O'Toole might be like top five actors all time for me.
He's very good.
But I think it's Ratatouille that seals the deal.
Say we'll someday talk about Lawrence of Arabia, right?
I still cannot believe you haven't seen it, Nick.
I'm just sad that after all this time, you're just going to have to watch it at home.
Yeah.
I know.
Well.
Yeah.
Maybe by the time we get to it, theaters will have opened up and they'll have decided to.
Theaters will be back open showing.
I'm going to find like a drive-in at like Indiana that is showing the movie. I'm going to buy you a ticket and make you drive all the way out there first.
I think watching it at drive-in would probably be suboptimal.
You'd probably be better with your home theatrical. Yeah. Your home theater is probably going to serve you better than a drive-in.
You do have a dope home theater, so.
Yeah. It's not like you're watching it on your laptop or something.
I will, though, just for a...
on your phone. You're just going to just stream it on your phone just to prove a point.
Most of these movies I've seen on my computer, so.
I watched Dr. Zhivago on a plane. I feel like I didn't get the full Dr. Zhivago experience.
Wow. Yeah, no, I mean, I only watch really bad movies on planes, typically. But like, I watched
How long
Hawkman.
Was that plane ride?
It was to Ireland.
So, okay. Long. Yeah, I watched Aquaman on a plane.
Aquaman on a plane.
The only thing is, though, I'm sitting there going, the only thing is I'm sitting there going, like, you know, these visual effects might have looked cool on a real screen that wasn't, like, the back of this American Airlines airplane, but I'll never know.
Yeah.
I gave it the appropriate level of attention it deserved. It was fine.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It's one of the better DCEU movies, at least.
The hardest I laughed in a movie that year was a scene where Patrick Wilson dramatically leaves a confrontation by just swimming backwards. And he, like, literally, it's the funniest thing. You guys, I did a little shoulder. He does. He goes like this and just swims backwards. And I don't think it's the supposed to be funny, but it was like the most I laughed at anything in the movie that year. It's really got to be seen to be believed. And Patrick Wilson's such like a serious actor. Like, he mm-hmm. takes everything so seriously. Ugh. Yeah, Aquaman.
He's very nondescript, too.
Yes, very.
He's just this, like,
generically handsome, but emphasis on the generic. All right, so yeah, we talked about after he leaves the park, he's all excited. He talks to his agent. He meets him at a restaurant. This is where I wrote down, because this is one of the places he starts describing things as being fab, which Ebert calls out as like kids today, not appreciating people calling things fab, which, fine, sure. But also, this is when he's being followed at this point, right? Like, he notices
he thinks
that it
he's
looks
being
like,
followed.
Yeah, he seems to be under the impression that he's being followed. There's also a, we check in with an anti-nuclear war protest.
Oh, yeah,
that
would be
a note.
Right?
Like, someone just sticks a sign in the back of his car, like, yeah, that'll do. He just starts driving off.
Yeah. And I wasn't sure it was like nuclear power, nuclear war. It's just like, they're mad about the nukes, though. Sticks the sign in the back of his car. He goes back home. And anyway, Vanessa Redgrave tracks him down, finds out where he is, and has come to demand the film. And they have like a weird sort of tête-à-tête back and forth power play that involves them
Harvey
getting
Weinstein.
Naked. Yeah, it involves them getting naked. Him and her. It's very strange.
There's the weird phone call too, which I don't understand.
Wow, that was the weirdest thing.
Yes, that is. I did not understand that either.
It really reminded me of the Big Sleep phone call where the police call and he's like, "Yeah, talk to my mother."
Right. Is that when he brings up saying like it's his wife?
Yeah, he says it's my wife, and then he says, "Well, she's not really my wife." But we have kids. And he's, well, we don't really have kids, turns out.
Yeah, we live together, but no, we don't live together.
If he's talking about the Patricia, was that her name?
I
assume that's who he was talking to at the moment. And I don't know if it's supposed to be unclear to us or...
No, I think that's at least who I assumed he was talking about.
Yeah.
Or who he's talking to.
Right, so when he's like... Is it that he just wishes she was his wife, or like?
But then he's like, but she's beautiful. But then she's not beautiful. But then we get along at least. And he's like, no, we don't get along. And so like, I can't imagine he's wishing for it. Also, he says she's not beautiful, and yes, she is beautiful. Like, the fuck is wrong with men?
Well,
I was gonna say in these days, but generally.
But, all the time.
I mean, everything he says to Vanessa Redgrave is a lie. Their whole interaction is just them lying to each other.
It's an interesting dialogue, at least, until it...
Exactly, and then it kind of culminates with him, you know, she demands the negatives, and he gives her fake ones. He switches it out and does not give her the actual film. So.
Vanessa Redgrave trying to dance to smooth jazz music is...
Oh, my God.
Like, such a mood. Just...
I have that written down.
She's spasming.
Yes.
She looks like she's never heard music before.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
That was so funny.
And
that
someone
was
is just like, oh, yeah, you bob your head and beat to the music, and she's never heard it. And she just goes, oh, like this.
And she's
and
never
like,
seen dancing.
Like,
yeah.
It's like
she's
an
trying
alien
to dance
trying
someone
to learn
describe.
How to dance.
Right. She's never seen dancing, and someone just described it to her. She's like this? Yeah. Yeah, it's very strange. And I made another note here. I mean, this, like you're saying, Dylan, this is just another, like, one of his most control freak kind of, you know, scenes. Bad guy, but it does not make me necessarily less invested in his story. He switches the negatives, gets rid of her. There's a brief scene where, like, his buddy shows up with a propeller. You know the part I'm talking about? Like,
yeah, the propeller was pretty funny.
The propeller was pretty funny. It's like, well, that's a propeller. Okay. But more importantly, now is when we get to like him deciding he wants to start looking at the photographs and start developing them. And blowing them up, as it were. And actually developing the pictures and starting to look at them. And this, like, it's a, we talked about it a second ago, but it is a pretty cool sequence and, like, really well edited, where you see him sort of literally putting the pieces together as he develops all the pictures and hangs them up and then rearranges them and starts spotting different things. Even if half the time I was looking at them, like, squinting, kind of being like, wait, what does he see there?
And there's, it's a not couple until, times, like, it just zooms in on the picture and it's like, there's nothing there.
It's just a blurry black, like, smudge. And I wasn't sure if there was supposed to be, like, a revelation or not. But eventually blows up one of them and you do see what looks like somebody with a gun. And he keeps coming back to this one photograph of Vanessa Redgrave's character. Jane, that's not her name. Jane, I was right. Vanessa Redgrave's character,
I kept writing Vanessa Redgrave in my notes.
I did too.
I know.
I mean, again, if I had told you she didn't even have a name, probably would have been believable.
I don't even remember them saying Thomas's name in the movie, honestly.
They don't say people's names.
Yeah, the only reason I know that is because of Letterboxd and Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. But he keeps cutting back to this one shot of her, like, looking into the bushes or the trees off to the side, and then back to what she's looking at, and starts to become concerned that there, you know, the guy is dead, and that there's a guy with a gun in the park. So,
He thinks he calls his friend. I don't know if it's the agent or who, but he calls somebody and says something fantastic's happened, because he doesn't realize that one of the pictures supposedly has a body. He just sees the gun, and you know, he thinks back, like, well, I didn't see anyone or hear anyone get shot, so I must have done a good.
Right, I must have intervened and prevented a
good job
murder or something taking place. Yeah, because he just sees the guy with the gun. As he has developed the photos, our old friends, the blonde and brunette, show back up at his place.
Yeah,
and my notes here just have the words "romp" in quotes with, like, a question mark, because I had seen it sort of described as, like, a romp, and then I'm like, he's just throwing them around.
Yeah.
Like, it's, and they're making these noises that I think from context they're supposed to be giggling.
That's what I was under the impression of.
So I'm like, I don't know.
They kind of sound like they're screaming, though.
They sound like they're screaming.
Yeah.
And then he's kind of, like, laughing. It's not the most comfortable to watch. And they're, like, tearing down the, like, backdrops in the photo studio. And, it's not the sexiest of romp scenes.
No, I mean, nor should it be, because it starts off as, like, just sexual harsmment. And it progresses to what is still under the umbrella of sexual harassment, but what seems clearly to be a transactional relationship between the three of them, because when they're done, they seem pretty...
And then they don't get their transaction.
Yeah.
He says they can come back tomorrow.
Although, given the rest of the movie, I doubt that he's going to be in the mood to, like... I would love to see Blow Up 2, where, like, they come to his apartment and he's just like, I can't take pictures anymore. Like, I just don't have it in me. And they're like, well, we had a three-way with you yesterday. Take our pictures. And he's just like...
He's, like, broken by the entire...
Just murder me.
But then he does, and he's captured by the consumerism culture of mod photography with these two.
Yeah.
I'm not going
to... Although, maybe... Who knows?
I'm not going to lie. Maybe I would watch this movie. Like, I'll watch Blow Up, too.
I would, too. Weird. It's a weird scene. And then, eventually, like, he has to get dressed again, and so, like, they put his clothes back on him. Like, it's a very... It's just all very... strange. But he basically tells them to get lost. They're mad about their photos, but he does say they can go back tomorrow, so who knows. We'll stay tuned for the sequel when they show back.
I mean, we all know what he looks like in the morning the next day.
Yeah, it's true. And so then this is now that he's gotten rid of them, I guess, had to deal with that whole situation, he goes back to the park to go poking around what he thinks, I guess, might have been the scene of a crime. And he finds a body, chilling, in the park, just laying there.
Dead.
I have some questions.
Dead.
And I think we're supposed to have some questions about, like, what we're supposed to think transpired or what he thinks transpired. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it's just because he was there at the park. She ran off. We never heard any gunshots. Like, I don't even know. It doesn't even necessarily appear that this body he finds has any wounds or anything. I didn't
know.
Not that we see.
I almost feel like he just had a heart attack. I mean, he's kind of old.
Right? I mean, I think it's in the
Ebert
essay.
And he's with Vanessa Redgrave, so.
I think it's in the Ebert essay where it's like, look, Occam's razor, path of least resistance. Like, he dropped dead. They're fooling around. He's old. He dropped dead, and she panicked and is like, oh my God. And that's why she runs off in such a panic. That makes sense. The only issue it maybe sort of raises is, like, where does the body go later? But, you know, someone carried it away.
Yeah,
someone else stumbled upon it and called. Yeah,
yeah,
a jogger
saw it and
found
called
it.
Whatever 911 is over there.
Right. As opposed to just leaving it in the park, which is what he does.
In fairness, he hears something.
Yes. Yeah, he does hear. And this is where we get sort of this recurring, like you were saying, how it's not really paranoid. Like, there's these flashes of what in another movie would be more of the focus of the movie, like when he thinks he's being followed or when he hears a noise, and, you know, but it's not really the, you know, the focus of most of it. But he does have these moments where he starts to have concerns about what is going on.
Yeah. And I thought, and tell me if you guys noticed this too or if I'm just crazy, but while he's in the park, did it sound like there was a clicking noise going on, like, while he's walking around? Okay.
Yep. Yeah. I heard that too.
And I don't even know if it's supposed to be like there's someone else and it's a camera shutter, or if it's just something in the background that's supposed to kind of, like, unsettle you a little bit or what.
Right.
But
The Wikipedia summary, it supposedly says that it's someone, like, stepping over twigs.
I thought that was the very last, like...
Very last snap?
Because we hear...
When he goes back to the...
Yeah, we hear just, like, a very... Or I thought I heard, anyway, just, like, a very quiet, like, every now and then you'd hear, like, a...
Yeah.
But then the last one that, like, causes him to run is... sounds different. It sounds like it's closer and louder and...
Right.
So I don't know. That's... Maybe I'm, like... way overthinking things, but that's how it sounded. It sounded like a shutter going off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of similar to that, especially because we've seen him, like, doing it's the kind of photography, like the tick, tick, tick kind of noise. So that makes sense. He goes back. He gets scared off. He goes back, and I can't remember which happens first, but he goes back to his studio. I think he goes back to his studio and then his house, which one first, but and basically, like, all of his stuff is gone, or like some of his stuff has been stolen, but there is still the one blow up there, and this is also when he goes back again, I think, to his house. I showed you guys last night in my notes when we think he stumbles upon his neighbors having sex, maybe. but it's like, this is definitely in
well,
this
they're definitely
act
having
where
sex.
Things,
like,
they're definitely having
that's,
sex.
That's
yeah,
not
that,
the,
that's not
that's not the,
that's not the maybe part. but this is definitely in this whole final act where just things don't really make sense anymore. Like, nothing's really happening in a way that linearly makes any sense. You know, that's like, with some guys, I was like, who are these people? Is this his wife? I guess it's not his wife. You know, and she looks at him like they have this kind of moment where she seems like she feels bad or is sad or he's sad.
She's also kind of like, get the fuck away, man.
But kind of also, why are you standing there staring at us? Like, we are having sex. And he just enters this sort of dreamlike atmosphere. He heads back into town, and this is now my favorite scene where he goes to the club.
No.
It is okay.
Okay, even I'm even like, I did some Letterboxd review, like, looks. A lot of my people I follow gave it 5 out of 5. I don't get it, but whatever. But even there's a guy, Carlos Vaidares, I don't know if his name is his name right. He pours loads of prides in a 5 out of 5 star review. And then his last sentence is, I still hold contempt for the orgy and the Yardbird scene. And his top comment is on this post is, haha, I was reading this, getting ready to comment, like, yeah, but what about the crummy Yardbird scene? But you covered it at the end.
I genuinely don't know what the objection is. Like, I genuinely don't know what's crummy about it.
It has absolutely, like, no energy in it. It doesn't
feel
very
well shot.
But I
think that's what's on purpose. Like, I think that lack of energy, like, it was so unsettling to me. I was like, and at first I thought it was just bad filmmaking. Like, at first I was like, why is everyone just standing? Like, is this how people went to clubs back in the day? Okay, well, I'm not really standing up for the scenes on the stage where they're like messing with the
but
with the
it
amp.
Has to have with the amp. The amp nonsense is not the best, but it has to happen because he has to get frustrated. He has to smash the guitar so that then a riot can break out amongst all these people who were just standing perfectly still, sitting.
And they didn't even
still.
Seem to be into the music.
That's what's so unsettling about it. That's what sort of adds to me for the sort of unreal, detached quality, dreamlike quality of this last sequence. Because, yeah, for me, it was so strange. I expected it to be like a big rocking club.
And everyone's
right. Yeah, they're all dancing like Vanessa Redgrave, just sort of moving back and forth. I would have loved that. But they stand perfectly still. It's so creepy. And then a riot breaks out because he smashes his guitar.
Breaks an amp, smashes his guitar. Who's the lead singer of the Yardbirds again? The guy that electrocuted himself.
Right, I'd say at that time, I can't remember what his name is.
But he just keeps on singing. Like,
yeah, I like that. I thought that was funny.
I'm so mad at this. I can't believe I missed WNBA opening day for this. To be fair, that's on my own planning fault. But
that is. You postponed watching this movie for so long that...
I missed half of opening day, and that was a bummer.
I'm going to not be reacting in real time to the Dodgers game either. So
yeah, Clevinger just gave up back-to-back solo home runs.
I was going to say, are you serious?
Yeah, that's if you guys saw my face, that's what my face was.
Yeah, I did see your face. You
see? I have the WNBA scoreboard open right now. That's
our
what's
focus
in
is
my
very
background.
Much on this movie. Yeah, the Dodgers are somehow down 3-1 to the Giants, and I just feel bad for Alex Wood.
Well, the Sparks beat the Mercury 99-76.
Oh, that's not a fun.
Do you guys follow the NBA at all?
No.
Oh, well.
Mostly just.
I feel mostly just generally baseball. Alone in my WNBA fandom.
Yeah, I'm going to say very much just baseball, but.
That's poor Clevinger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you guys hear that Regis Philbin died, though?
Yeah. I did, yeah. Like right
Yeah, they interrupted
recording.
The middle of a WNBA game to say
not
Regis
really.
Philbin died. Yeah. They did it like the whole OJ car chase, like where they would like literally cut away from the actual game.
I just had the thing happen where I opened Twitter and all of a sudden everyone was posting Regis Philbin clips and I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
You don't get that moment to have the Denzel meme that you always see whenever someone's trending that's old, which is just like...
Right. Oh God. Here we go.
I love when they post that gif.
Yeah, they pulled Alex Wood. Okay. So...
Sorry. Blow up.
Our buddy Thomas makes his way out of the club
with the guitar neck.
So he escapes.
I really enjoy the fact that he gets the guitar neck. Everyone wants it. He has to run out. He gets onto the street. He looks at it and he's just like, I don't want this. And he throws it.
Exactly. Throws it down.
Love
that.
Someone else even picks it up and they're like, yeah. And they just throw it back down.
Right, because out of the context of in that club, you're like, this is a piece of garbage. Why this guy just threw a piece of garbage on the street?
That was my very first moment of liking this movie. Because I thought that was a really good allegorical motif.
I think it's the best, like, one of the best moments in the movie. Like,
yeah,
I agree.
Like, okay, I'm not going to spoil it, but I am going to generally give this movie a positive rating. Because the last act is pretty damn good. And
you
that
just,
was the
just,
first...
You just like that they play tennis at the end. That just turns you around on the entire movie.
It's terrible tennis playing, but that's besides the point.
They're trying to do it without a ball, in fairness.
It gave me terrible flashbacks, too. I don't know if you guys ever took like theater classes or drama classes in school. I did for a while. And it's just so funny how like that is a like drama class 101. It's like just miming. You got no props. It's all... All they let you do when you first start taking drama classes, like, you're going to act out this scene, but you have to, you know, open. Speaking of, it's it's burning, right? Where she peels.
That's exactly what I had in my notes.
Right.
Is that,
yeah, I was gonna say.
Wait, what's burning? You cut out there for a second.
Oh, sorry. Where she peels the orange or the tangerine or whatever. She's doing the miming.
Oh yeah.
And she does like the very effective, I think. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
That was the exact metaphor that I had written down. Is that the tangerine, like with the tennis ball, or really like the body and the murder itself, like the tangerine. I forget the quote that they use in Burning, but it's something like, you don't pretend that it's there, you have to forget that it's not there.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's sort of,
it's about forgetting it's not there.
Yeah. That's what David does, or what Thomas does at the end with the tennis ball. But I guess we'll get to it. But the question is, like, is he doing the same thing, or has he done the same thing with this whole murder thing?
Sure. Yeah.
And also with his art, honestly.
Right. Yeah.
Well, so there's one more scene before we get to the park and tennis miming. He goes to a party.
People are
getting high. They're smoking weed. I think his agent, Ron, is there.
I don't
know why that person's head name and face just
that's
can't
the only
in my
one
brain.
That's stuck in your head.
I know. Also, Varushka is there. Really great exchange where I thought you were going to Paris, and she says, I am in Paris. So the reality of the situation that we're in, I mean, she's probably just extremely high, but the reality of the situation that we're in tends to break down. I did enjoy when he says, I think it's to Ron, I want you to see the corpse, which is like the least appealing sentence you can say to somebody. It's like, no, thank you. I'm going to say no to that.
You should call the authorities.
Right, exactly. I want you to see the corpse. Like, or do literally anything else with a corpse, please. But after his brief detour to the party, goes back to the park at that point, and of course the body is gone. I forgot, he falls asleep, wakes up sort of disoriented, alone in the party house, and then makes his way back to the park and the body is gone. And it just really contributes to the whole dreamlike atmosphere of everything, where like, how much of this happened, did any of it happen, like what is he knowing or not knowing. And while he's wandering around the park, our good friends from the beginning, the mimes slash clowns slash
college students.
If they are college students who are doing this to raise money for charity, then their commitment to the bit of going to this park to play mime tennis, like,
this park is completely barren also.
Right, there's no one there. They're not. It's not like they're doing this in front of a crowd to raise money, but maybe it's a rehearsal. Who knows? But they're just really committed to this lifestyle.
Yeah.
But they roll up in the car and they start playing tennis, and he like sort of gets into it. He sort of gets looped into this fantasy, and a tennis ball escapes, and he chases the ball for them, and he hears the tennis match happening. You can hear the ball bouncing all of a sudden.
I love the way the camera, when the supposed ball goes over the fence, the camera follows it as if it goes over the fence, and then as if it like bounces and rolls.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it's the camera is also very in on the mime bit. Like it's really good. And he chases the ball and then throws it back, and then from off screen you hear the sounds of an actual tennis match, and you hear the ball bouncing and a rally going on, and he walks into the grass, and then he himself fades away as if he were never there at all. The end. And Dylan was thrilled with the entire experience.
Again, it was no Belle du Jour for me.
That's good. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
I think especially because I think the movie ended a lot better than Belle du Jour did.
I'm gonna say, what do you think of the end? I mean, what do you think it all means? What
I think
is he
it means
to
exactly what I talked about with the guitar, which is just like, I mean, I don't want to. I think this is always the most pretentious and stupid sentence in history, but like, what is art? But it is kind of just like, he's kind of just miming art. Like, there's nothing really serious about what he does, except, you know, sexual
abuse
and stuff. But in and of itself, the stuff that the movie actually cares about. You know, he's no different from these, like, stupid mimes playing tennis right. for charity.
Sure.
Which, the mimes seem super fun. I'd love to mime tennis with them, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the only people in the movie I think are cool. The mimes. So that
you just
tells
hang
you something.
Out with the mimes. Hey, you know, they're either having a good time, so, you know.
Yeah, I think I could beat those mimes at mime tennis, though, because they look more like they were playing badminton than anything. Like, they're hitting completely underhand at a few points,
well,
and I'm like...
They're not that good. They can't even keep the ball in the court.
They're hitting the ball out of the court.
Okay,
so.
To be fair, I do really bad about that, too.
Yeah.
I have, like, a wicked forehand that either goes in or it goes over the fence. I can hit it really fast. Where the ball
goes,
though.
Lacking some of that control.
Yeah, yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah, so that's the movie. Just a couple quick notes on its reception. This film won, what was it at the time, called the Grand Prix, which was that year's version of the Palme d'Or. And it was nominated for 2 Academy Awards for director and, oddly enough, original screenplay, when there's multiple references to this being based on a short story of some kind. So
I
don't know
even,
how it swung
like,
that original screenplay nomination.
Even in the credits, it's... says it's based on.
It says based on, yeah. So I don't know. I have eligibility questions.
On some overall things I had a problem with, I didn't think the screenplay was that great, honestly. I'm surprised out of every... Like, I honestly think this could be a really good like sound design nomination. I think the sound in it is really good. Mm-hmm. I think the music they put in it is really good too. I don't know how much of it is original though. But the music in it is very good. I think the set design's very good. So I'm just surprised out of everything like it got screenplay, because I didn't think the screenplay really stood out as a positive for me of whatever positives I had.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I think I guess like one of those situations where the screenplay is good for its structure, if not for its dialogue.
I really like a lot of the lines in the screenplay. There's a lot of things that feel like throwaway lines. When you come back, you're like, oh, like,
I guess when I wrote down a bunch of the lines, so I guess I did also like a bunch of the lines.
Like when he's talking to his artist friend early on, and he's like, oh, like, I forget what the quote is. I think I have it written down, but something along the lines. Oh, he says, they don't mean anything when I do them. Just a mess. Afterwards, I find something to hang on to. Just things like little touches like that I like a lot. And it's the sort of thing that I got more out of. I found more instances like that on a rewatch than I did, I think, the first time I watched this.
Right.
Do you guys know who beat him for Best Director, by the way?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Is it the guy who did A Man for All Seasons?
Yeah, Fred Zimmerman from Man for All Seasons.
That's
another
weird
snooze fest.
I was going to say, I shouldn't say this is a weird Oscar year, but this is an Oscar year where just like...
It's not a ton of movies
that I have a strong connection to.
No.
Put it that way.
The only movie this year from like the picture director group that's really even highly revered, I mean, I guess outside of Blow Up, nowadays is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which that's a damn good movie.
Yeah, which out of those of the ones I've seen, that one's my favorite. But there were, I mean, this year outside of like the Oscar pool, there was like, I think Andrei Rublev came out this year.
Oh, that's the best.
I looked at it earlier today. There were a few like Seconds by John Frankenheimer. The Batman.
What year is this?
66?
66.
Okay, let me see.
The Batman movie.
Batman 66, yeah.
Oh, I really enjoyed that Batman movie.
You know who was nominated? So Vanessa Redgrave was nominated for Best Actress, but for a different movie.
What?
This year. I mean, she's barely in this movie. Yeah. So it's not like she should have been nominated for this. Like, she is barely in it. Vanessa and Lynn Redgrave were both nominated for Best Actress this year. Wow. Yeah, that's fun.
A family affair.
This year is actually really good. They have Daisies, which I know that's not an Oscar movie, but that movie's incredible.
Oh, Good, the Bad,
the
and
good
the
Ugly. The Good and the
Ugly.
Yeah. Black Girl, which
kind
of was the breakthrough for African cinema. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Persona, Battle of
Algiers. Oh, Persona, that's right. Persona's the best.
Persona's great.
Ibira, Horror of the Deep, one of the worst Godzilla movies.
I was going to say, I'm the what now? Of the what?
Yeah. It's a
good year.
This is the
Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Oh, that's the animated solid
movie.
One?
One of my daughter's favorite movies.
It's a good, that's a good, a great pick. Great pick.
Yeah.
Much better than Blow Up.
Good. Isn't it also like 22 minutes long? Like, yeah. I don't think it's
care. I will stand by that statement.
Joked on that. One quick fun fact that I stole from Wikipedia was that apparently Sean Connery was approached to play the role of Thomas in this movie, which, like,
was
that would have been...
Was he Bond at that point yet?
Mm-hmm. He was a couple
years
into Bond.
That could
have
actually made some sense, actually. That would have been interesting.
But apparently Antonioni wouldn't show him the script and wanted him to just accept the role without seeing the script. And Connery, I think to his credit, said no. Like, I mean, I think it would have been good in the movie, but I don't blame someone for saying, well, no, I'm not going to agree to be in your movie if you won't let me see the script. That seems fair. And then I also have a quick Kale Corner update.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yes, she reviewed this movie in The New Republic. She is a little bit more of a Dylan on this movie. Unsurprisingly, she's not as enthused. Couple of quotes from her review. She says, "But for reasons I can't quite fathom, what is taken to be shallow in his hero is taken to be profound in him. Maybe it's because of the symbols. Do pretty pictures plus symbols equal art?" So she kind of is.
I actually really agree with that.
Yeah. And then she says, basically, she kind of pokes at it for taking itself too seriously, I think. Because she says, who the hell goes to movies for mature adult sober art anyway? Yes, we want more from movies than we get from the usual commercial entertainments, but would anybody use terms... Here's where it gets interesting. Would anybody use terms like mature, adult, and sober for The Rules of the Game or Breathless or Citizen Kane or Jules and Jim? Like, those are some of the, like, most respected adult-considered movies of all time. I like how she's like, ugh, you know... Fun movies like Jules and Jim and Breathless.
God damn Jules and Jim.
But she loves Blow Out, though. When I was looking for her review of Blow Out.
Oh, nice.
Her review of Blow Out is like, it's so much better. I like that more. I mean, Pauline Kael did.
I think that's, I'm assuming we're transitioning into Ebert review comments.
Yes, yes.
I want to pick out this comment, which I wrote a bit of a curse word over. young audiences aren't interested anymore in a movie about trendy London photographer who may or may not have witnessed a murder in the life and cynicism and ennui, and who ends up at a park at dawn watching college kids play tennis with an imaginary ball. The children of the audience that bought tickets for a Blow Up prefer
ironic
self-referential slasher movies.
Yeah, he's really mad at Scream, and I don't know why. I don't know what Scream did to him, but he's mad about it.
Scream is a lot better than this movie, so...
Yeah. I don't know if it's... But I love Scream, but... But then he also says, Americans flew to swinging London in the 60s. Today's Londoners pile onto charter jets to Orlando. Like, I don't know what he's so mad about.
Who cares? Have them enjoy Disney World, Ebert.
Right, exactly. But no, I also, that was, I told you, I started
with that, like, paragraph, and I was like, oh no, this is going to go so bad. Especially because, one of the next sentences he had was, that this premiered at the Virginia Film of American, Festival of American Film in Charlottesville, which had cool as its theme. And I just wrote an eye roll.
Yeah,
like, what the heck?
He goes on to say that he had just done one of his frame-by-frame analysis of it, which I think is cool, and he talks a little bit about how, like, this movie, I think, is particularly well-served to that, because so many things do happen, like, in a blink, that it's kind of an interesting...
And definitely within the frame more than the dialogue.
Exactly.
But after that, he got real... I thought he made a lot of great points that made me think of the movie a little bit more positively.
After his digs at Scream in South Park, He was just on one when he was writing this. He was mad at the youths. But he does, like I said, he refers to Austin Powers as brilliantly lampooning the era.
Oh, yeah.
So he likes the Austin Powers.
Austin Powers
parody.
Is great.
They're good movies. The first one's good. It's diminishing returns after that, but I like the Spy Who Shagged Me.
I love Spy Who Shagged Me.
Spy Who Shagged Me is my favorite one of the three.
The third problem
one isn't that good.
The only problem with Spy Who Shagged Me is it introduces Fat Bastard, like one of the worst characters in
The only problem with the first one is it doesn't have Fat Bastard.
Oh, God. I hate
No, I'm kidding.
So much. Okay, I was like, I cannot engage. I can't.
Okay, this is the thing. I saw Shrek first, so I can't not just hear Shrek when Fat Bastard is on TV.
I am old.
So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Thank you. I was going to say, as an older person, I grew up watching So I Married an Axe Murderer, which is my go-to Michael Myers Scottish God. Mike Myers. I refer to him
Those are my favorite slasher movies.
Also, he's a serial killer. No, that was my go-to Mike Myers. Talk about a movie that has like a really great first 20 minutes, and then I just don't remember anything else that happens in it.
I've never
seen Married
this
an
movie.
Axe Murderer is like very funny, and then
it's a good movie.
I loved it when I was a kid. Anyway, Austin Powers digression. Yeah, I do feel like, so Ebert obviously loves this movie. He calls it one of the great movies, hence why we're talking about it. He is kind of with you, though, Dylan. He does describe the group photo shoot as having grotesque mod fashions,
yes.
Which he's wrong. They all look
Which,
great.
Again, I can understand how, like, you guys and Ebert, that doesn't, like, ruin the movie for you. But
yeah.
It does really take a lot of the movie out for me.
Okay, and then before we get to the things we like that Ebert said, I do, after I praised him, by saying how he, you know, didn't comment on the women's bodies or skimpy outfits or anything, all of which is true. When he describes the blonde and the brunette coming to the house, and he says Thomas is interrupted by two girls who have been pestering him all day and engages in wild sex play as they roll around in crumpled backdrop paper. I'm like, I just don't know if that's how I would describe that interaction, but sure, why not? That being said, what did you guys like that Ebert said in this essay, which I think we all agree is one of his better ones?
Yeah, it was a great one.
That we've had in a while. He doesn't just talk about the genre and then describe other movies that are not this movie.
He talks about Shoeshine for 200 words.
Just quotes Pauline Kael's review. All right.
I really wish I could have just been with the editor at that point who got that review and was just like,
right? What is this?
Fine.
He was long
sure.
past the point of having to answer to an editor.
You're Ebert.
All right, Nick, what part do you like of the Ebert essay?
I have a longer one, but it's the
sure.
passage where he says, the film is about a character mired in ennui and distaste who is roused by his photographs into something approaching passion. As Thomas moves between his dark room and the blow-ups, we recognize the bliss of an artist lost in the creative zone. Which
yeah.
It sums up the movie pretty well.
It pretty much does. And I will say that section there, I highlighted like the very beginning where he just says whether there was a murder isn't the point, which is like what you learn. It's just not what this is about. What about you, Dylan?
You just guys said the two things I underlined.
Sorry.
Let me see if there's something. I circled a lot of stuff, so I'll have something in here. This is something I want to point out. There were reasons, of course, for the film's great initial success. It became notorious for the orgy scene involving the groupies. It was whispered that you could actually see pubic hair. He talks about Janet Leigh's breasts for a little bit. The decadent milieu was enormously attractive at that time. Parts of the film have flip-flopped in meaning, and that's kind of when we talk about something.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, so, he, like, praises, like, the audience in the beginning for, like, this was the audience that liked to learn about the photographer's life of cynicism and ennui. And I think the reason why it was the most popular, like, art film of the time was pubic hair. So, like, yeah. I don't think it was much beyond that. To me, I don't think audiences have changed since the 60s.
I think that's a fair observation. You're right. He praises audiences at the time for loving a serious art film like this.
Yeah.
And then
but
goes
then,
on
like,
to say that this movie was controversial because they thought that a woman got full frontal naked. Like, so
and, like,
I think,
that was the whole big reason that people went to see it. And so, you know,
yeah.
I just thought that was interesting. I don't think Ebert meant to make that connection, but that's something I would argue to Ebert.
Yeah.
But it, I do think it was a good thing you pointed out. So yeah, he did a great write up in this one.
Mm-hmm. He did. I really liked both of those, and I actually liked how he wraps up his essay too, right after the part you just quoted.
Yeah.
Bill, and he where he says, "What remains is a hypnotic conjuring act in which a character is awakened briefly from a deep sleep of bored alienation and then drifts away again. That is the arc of the film." Like, mm-hmm. and it kind of is. He's just sort of checked out, and then he has this strange day. And then he just fades away again. Yeah, and like
he literally fades away. Like
yeah, and nothing.
That's a great like. There he is, and then there he is.
Yeah, yeah.
And then big old blow up mm-hmm. comes up on the screen.
It's good.
It is very good.
So all right, after all that, Dylan, did you land on the thumbs up side?
I can't decide.
Well, it's definitely a thumbs up from me.
Okay, Nick.
Thumbs up.
You gotta pick one. I don't think you're allowed to not pick.
I know.
One must pick.
Okay, I'm like thumbs down on like 90% of this movie, but you know what?
I mean, it's okay. If you want to give it a thumbs down, you are allowed.
I'll go up.
Okay.
I mean, I'm definitely gonna be the negative or more negative. Well, say
what number of stars were you willing to allot to this based on?
I'll give it 2.5 out of 4.
Okay. All right. That's not bad. Where'd you land, Nick?
I'm going to go 3.5.
I am also a 3.5.
Oh, yeah. I really hoped at least one of you would go 3.
No, nah. I'm also 3.5. I dug it.
Yeah. It's a good movie. It's fun. Yeah. I had fun.
It is fun.
It.
Is it?
I did too.
Is it fun?
I had fun with it also.
He just looks so, like in the last shot when he's watching the mimes or whoever play tennis. He just looks so beaten down.
Yeah.
And it really
kind
like
how I look right now.
Yeah, kind of like how you look right now.
It's at that part that I really like gained a lot more appreciation for David Hemmings as an actor, where mm-hmm. he goes from someone who you like actively despise mm-hmm. based on his actions in the first, you know, half of the movie, basically. Like the blow up part where he blows up where he does the mm-hmm. titular blow up.
Yeah.
I looked. It doesn't happen until after an hour into the movie.
Yeah,
like it takes a long time for him.
And the movie's
to blow
less
up.
Than 2 hours long. Yeah. Like it's so it, the whole that second half of the movie just really, like steamrolls right along. I had to pause it a couple times last night, and at one point I was like, I paused it and there was only like 30 minutes left and mm-hmm. there's so much happens in that final 30 minutes. Like it really just it hadn't even gone to the rock club yet. So.
Do you guys know who David Hemmings plays in Gladiator?
I saw that he was in Gladiator, but no.
You should look up David Hemmings Gladiator and then just be mind blown.
I will.
I'm not.
I thought he was
this.
Good too. I thought he was good too, by the way, in the movie. Oh shoot. he's like
I cannot believe that.
He's like the circus master or whatever. I don't know what that guy's title is in the movie. But he speaking of people being made up to look like clowns,
yeah.
Made up to look like a clown in Gladiator.
I am shocked. What the heck?
Yeah, good for him. I do think he's I wish I remembered what this character's name was. I'm going to look it up.
Cassius.
I feel bad. Cassius, yeah. Thank you. I do think he's good in the movie as well. I think even though the character is, you know, very clearly a jerk, he plays his moments. He plays it, you know, to the extent that he has this small arc, I think he plays it pretty well. So, all right. Do you guys have any other final thoughts or you think we covered everything?
I feel good with what I said. And I just want to move on to a more positive review in 2 weeks.
I was going
to
say, I don't know.
Body Heat.
Maybe. Yeah, I am. So just to confirm, Body Heat's going to be the first movie that none of us have seen?
I think
yes.
so. Yeah.
This is exciting.
It is exciting.
I agree.
So
I kind of wish I hadn't seen some of these movies so like we could have this like first time.
You hadn't seen Aguirre, right? That was the first time.
No,
for you?
I had seen Aguirre.
Oh, you had seen Aguirre.
Multiple
what
times.
What hadn't you seen?
This is my first, I think, that I haven't seen.
Really? Oh, that's right. Well, because you had this book when you were young, and so you
yeah, like
watched
this
these
book
movies.
Was my Bible, except for some weird Body Heat movie I never saw.
Well, I'm glad it's probably did not see
responsible.
Well, I saw Belle de Jure.
They probably wouldn't. Well, good point. That's strange. But Body Heat, I imagine they would like not let you.
But Belle de Jure doesn't even have like nudity in it, though, right?
Does right. It? Body no. Heat, I think, is like because we, as we talked about, Belle de Jure like doesn't really have sex scenes in it. In the end, like it doesn't have nudity or anything particularly. Body Heat, on the other hand, I think is, you know, an 80s movie. And
yes, that's all I can say.
Yeah.
Here, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go Body Heat. I'm going to click IMDb. And I'm going to see what it's rated.
Oh, it's...
on their parental guide.
Oh, see what
it is. The sex and nudity is severe.
I mean...
there you go.
Oh, Ted Danson's in it, and Mickey Rourke.
It's Lord, this is so 80s. William Hurt, Kathleen... well, Kathleen Turner's...
yeah.
Ted Danson, Crudup, Mickey Rourke. Danson. That is such an 80s cast.
Yep.
What happened to poor William Hurt?
Built a career on... some not great stuff. Being in the movie Lost in Space. Is one of the things that happened to William.
Oh,
Hurt.
Did that, like, tank his career?
I mean, I think his career was probably already not going great at that point. But, I mean, man's an Oscar nominee. He's in Broadcast News, one of the greatest movies of all time.
It is indeed.
This is a long way around of me saying thank you to everybody for joining us this week. As we just previewed our next week, we will be discussing Lawrence Kasdan's 1981 film Body Heat, which is streaming on HBO Max. So if you have the HBO Max platform, you can watch that. It's also available to rent or buy on all the other usual places.
William Hurt's in like a bunch of Marvel movies.
Oh yeah, Thaddeus Ross.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Thunderbolt
That's
Ross.
True.
Thunderbolt Ross.
Yeah.
Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross.
All of it.
Jana, you know a random Avengers character's name more than you do blow-ups.
I just finished doing a trivia league that was MCU-based, and I signed up for it being like, I'm going to be so good at this. And then it turns out the kind of people who write trivia about MCU movies are not messing around, and I didn't know like hardly anything. So it really, really showed me when I thought I could do that. All right, so until next week, when we regroup to talk about Body Heat and maybe do a deep dive on what William Hurt's been up to, until then, follow us on Twitter and Letterboxd at Great Movies Pod. We want to thank our friend Scott Brady, as always, for our artwork, and everyone should follow him on Twitter at SBradyArtist. And that is it
until next week. One more thing.
Until Nick updates us on something.
No, I keep forgetting to bring this up for the last two episodes, because apparently I didn't hear you say this. And then we just kind of move past it. But we need to talk about you seeing Alan Arkin.
Oh. Before we sign off, we're going to talk about me seeing Alan Arkin in a movie theater.
Because.
Great catch, Nick.
Because I want to know. I didn't hear it the first time. And then Dylan mentioned it off air. And I was like, wait, what?
Which Dylan only heard because he was editing the episode and was like, what did you say? It is so not a story worth interrupting the end of the podcast for.
Turn it into a half hour long story with like some arcs and some character background.
I was leaving, and I cannot tell you movie I was seeing. I can tell you that it was at some point between 2008 and 2015, probably.
That's a big one.
I was at the AMC Century City Movie Theater, and I was with my now husband, so it was sometime between 2008, and it definitely wasn't that recently, so it was probably around Argo time, like it was probably around 2012-ish, and I was...
How long were you and Matt dating before you guys got engaged?
6 years, and then 7 before we got married.
Gotcha,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we were together for 12 years.
that was just such a big jump, I was like, whoa.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so we were leaving the AMC Century City Movie Theater, and I hear, like, a man's voice behind me saying, like, I swear to God, he said something either, like, well, you know I was in that movie, or, like, your granddad was in that movie. And I turn around and look, and it is Alan Arkin walking with, like, a maybe young teenage-ish age boy out of the movie theater. No idea what movie he was referring to. I can't remember what movie we saw, but, like, Matt and I both just sort of stopped and, like, did the thing where we sort of, like, well, let's just let him pass us and walk by and walk out of the theater and then just watched him go, and it was like a nice, like, it made me happy that he was taking who I what I presume was his grandson to the movies just on some random weekend afternoon. I smiled at him as he walked by, and I did not exchange any words, so it was a very much like hello, and then out he went. But you know, seemed like a friendly guy.
Good story.
Nice.
Wholesome content.
Nice family man. Yeah. Yeah.
Really. By the way, what did you guys watch this week?
Oh, yeah. I watched Blow Up and a lot of baseball games, and then...
Indeed.
Just about... Watch. Yeah. That's really going to eat into my movie watching time, same. Unfortunately. The Dodgers play, like, every day. And this is not a movie, but I am almost done with Avatar Season 2. I think I have, like, one episode left. So... That's exciting. Tough times happening in the Earth Kingdom right now, but we'll see where it goes from here. Oh, and I'm going to watch the Avatar movie tomorrow for real this time,
nice.
Because another podcast that I listen to has like a Patreon, like a Slack for people in their Patreon, and they do a movie club. And tomorrow's and the July movie club is the Avatar movie, so I'm going to be watching that with a group online tomorrow.
Maybe at this rate, we should just do it once you've finished Avatar, though.
Yeah. Do a whole complete...
Yeah.
We're moving pretty quickly. We've gotten pretty into it. So we started slow, but
season
we're
two
really...
is a lot better than season one.
Yeah. So that's... But that's what's been going on. Not a ton
of
movies.
Have you cried yet?
No, although...
Oh, come on.
I know. I don't... Yeah. I was very worried about Appa for a while there, and then I was happy when there was a reunion. But that was sort of like the most emotional heartstring tugging that I had.
Not Tales of Ba Sing Se?
Tales of Ba Sing Se also. Poor Uncle Iroh. That was some rough stuff too. Yeah, mostly I'm just enjoying Momo's antics. I'm all in on Momo. That's pretty much my Avatar take. What have you been watching, Nick? Probably actual movies.
I watched Good Morning by Ozu, which was really good. I liked that quite a bit. I watched Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which is one of my favorite things I've watched all year. Maybe my favorite thing I've watched all year. That movie rules.
Fuck yeah. That movie does rule.
What else did I watch? I watched Gloria, which is a Cassavetes movie, which I wasn't that high on. It's about
Wasn't that what she won her Oscar for?
No, I don't think she's ever won. She was nominated for it. She's very good in it. But it's
Gina,
like,
Rollins?
Yeah, it's,
yeah,
it's,
she does, she never won one.
It's her with like a small child, and it's just like a god awful child performance. Just truly abysmal.
I mean, all I really know about that is Be Kind Rewinds, who does best actress races. I remember her talking about that movie, and that's like literally the only thing. I thought they had talked about her winning though, so
No, she lost to... she should have won for A Woman Under the Influence. She lost to Ellen Burstyn.
She lost to Ellen Burstyn for Alice Doesn't Love You
Which
Anymore.
Is a great performance, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But Woman Under the Influence is like my number one. And then I...
You watched Big Boss.
I cracked into the Bruce Lee box set last night. So we watched Big Boss.
Incredible review of Big Boss, by the way.
Yeah. When I was looking
at... Two words. Finger punches.
When I was looking at my Letterboxd, I forgot that I hadn't logged it last night. But yeah, it was pretty cool. I think it's probably like not as well revered as some of the later ones in the set, but it was like the first one that kind of made Bruce Lee blow up. So I had a good time with it. Looking forward to watching the other ones.
How does the Life and Death of Colonel Blimp fit in with like your Archer's ranking, by the way?
I don't know. They're all... I go back... I used to...
Perfect.
Yeah, I used to go back and forth all the time between which I liked more out of Red Shoes and Matter of Life and Death, and now I just have... It's three horse race, so they're all very, very good. I am really looking forward into diving into the commentary on that, because it is Michael Powell with our Martin Scorsese.
Oh, nice.
Scorsese does like his Archers.
Well, yeah, and his editor is married to Michael Powell, or was married to Michael Powell.
Really?
Wait, what?
Yeah, Thelma Schoonmaker and Michael Powell, one of the best cinematic power couples. Like, maybe the best.
What?
Depending on where Barry Jenkins and Oh, who made the farewell?
Oh, they weren't married that long until he died. That is sad.
Yeah.
But they were introduced by Scorsese. That's nice.
Oh, I didn't know that. Man.
Yeah, she was introduced by Scorsese.
What can't that guy do? Lulu Wang is who you're thinking.
Lulu Wang, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah, God. They're a great power couple.
Yep. Some good ones.
And then for me this week, I watched The Red Shoes.
Sure.
Good movie.
Which is the best, and I love it, and I just love it so much. And then I watched the best movie of all time, Harakiri, which I'm like.
I was like, how often do you watch that movie?
This is only the second time I've watched it.
Okay, but it's like the second time you've watched it in the past three months.
Yeah, the past couple months.
I'm like gonna continue to badger you guys to watch Harakiri because unbelievable how good that movie is, and like at the end my brother was just like repeatedly saying the word wow over and over again.
Fair enough, it's
very good, and guys, please watch it, because Ebert's not gonna force you guys to watch it.
No,
he was silly and didn't have it in his great movies, but
no, alas,
we'll get there.
All right,
we'll get to what? It's not there.
No, I mean, like, we'll get to
watching it.
There being watching Harakiri land.
Yes,
gotcha.
Exactly. Well, after that world's longest digression, when I had literally one sentence left to say in the podcast, we will see everyone next week.
All right,
Roger out.
Roger out.
Roger out, guys.
And when I go to the movies, I am that person on the screen. I am having vicariously an experience that happened to someone else. And that makes me a better person. That to see good films and to see important films is one of the most profoundly civilized experiences that we can have as people.
I'm going to use the restroom real quick, so can we pause?
Okay. Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Don't pause your recording.
Don't pause recording. Okay. Leave it.
No.
Sorry. Like, that's more trouble than it's worth. I'm going to check in on game day.
Yeah, I have this.
Who the fuck scored two runs? What's happening here?
Your game?
Yeah, Giants. Giants are up 2-1. Alex Wood, my man. What's going on?
Wait, why are you guys playing so much earlier? Our game hasn't even started yet.
It's like the Fox afternoon day game started at 1 o'clock. Yeah.
Yeah, because our game starts. I think Clevenger's warming up right now.
Nice. Okay, so Darren Ruff singled, scored Austin Slater, and then Justin Turner doubled and scored Cody. Oh, and then in the top of the second, a wild pitch scored Mike Yastrzemski. Alex Wood needs to
get it together.
Get it together a little bit.
Have they said how long Kershaw's going to be out, or do they know yet?
No, they said the MRI or x-rays or whatever came back clear or negative on, so they're optimistic, they're encouraged by what they've seen so far, and they made his DL or IL stint retroactive, so I think he'd be eligible as early as next weekend. Okay. But they haven't made any sort of promises, and Dustin May is going to start again on Wednesday. Okay. So
he is he made a couple of starts
and they used him in relief a couple times too.
He's really fun to watch pitch. He's got like a ridiculous leg kick, and he can throw fast as hell.
Yeah. Oh, he looks great. He throws some nasty stuff. I was very pleased with how he was looking on Thursday night.
He didn't throw a lot of strikeouts, though, I don't think.
What did you do?
No.
I mean, is he like a sinker ball guy, though? Like, I saw that he. Mm-hmm. I saw somebody say he can throw like a 100-mile-an-hour sinker. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he's good. He's pretty young.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But I was pretty pleased with how that went. Although I will say, Dylan
Clevenger looks like a fisherman.
He does. He looks like I mean, one of Matt and mine's favorite things is pointing at a guy and saying, "That's a professional athlete." And Clevenger is like that. Where it's like, yeah, that guy. He's a professional athlete. But Dylan, you were saying you felt bad about yourself because you didn't know who Dustin May was, and he was in 14 games last year. Last night when Dylan Floro came in relief, I was like, Dylan Floro's on the Dodgers? And I like looked him up. I'm like, okay, I guess he left and came back. Oh, he pitched in 50 games last year. Wow. Okay, great. Like, so then I was like, okay, well, now I feel really bad. Because I'm like, was he on the team last year? 50 games he was in. And I just, no memory. Sorry, Dylan Floro, you are too anonymous. Like, it's, he could go in one of those reliever quizzes where it's just like, country music singer or reliever.
Good His question. Salary is $507,000, though, so.
Well, I'd take it.
Yeah. I did one on my other podcast for people who don't listen, who don't follow baseball, and it was a Houston Astros pitcher or justified character.
Oh, I mean, I could ace that, but that would be a very fun one to like do.
Colin McHugh.
Sure.
Dallas Keuchel. I mean, like, Dallas Keuchel sounds like a...
Dallas Keuchel. I don't know if you could convince anyone that an Astros pitcher is named Dewey Crow, but you could try.
Dewey Crow could be an Astros pitcher, too.
Right?
Like, you never know.
Yeah. What is... oh, my gosh. The Margo Martindale family.
Oh,
the Bennetts. Yeah,
Dickie
I feel
Bennett.
Like... Yeah, maybe Dickie Bennett's a pitcher. You don't know.
That sounds like a old-timey pitcher.
Right, yeah. A little old school.
Anyway.
All right. Well, we cut off right before things are about to get real good in the movie, by the way. So,